You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Hugo Chavez's campaign to extend his presidency from 14 years to 20 enters its final 48 hours, we'll have the latest from our correspondent in Caracas. From Venezuela, we'll be directing our electoral crystal ball southwards to Brazil, where the country is voting in municipal elections, including in the very small town of Bora.
Only 805 people live there. And there was a case where the mayor was elected just by one vote.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Returning to the subject of presidential elections, which might end up being closer than the incumbent might have imagined or desired, we'll be crossing to the United States to watch Barack Obama's attempt to climb off the mat following Wednesday night's surprise flooring by Mitt Romney. After UK Education Secretary Michael Gove declares, for reasons surpassing understanding, that schools must not be curved, we'll speak to the Royal Institute of British Architects about how innovative design is conducive to education.
We're quite concerned that the approach being taken by the government doesn't reflect the fact that different people will learn in different ways, that different teachers will want to teach in different ways.
And after 10 years of the Frieze Festival, we speak to the director about his plans to introduce historic masters to the exhibition lineup.
We just had a gut feeling that contemporary art had a longer way to go, had more interest to come, that it was really interesting and enough people were interested. And that's sort of how we feel now about historical art, because the pendulum sort of swung.
All that and a song or two as well coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all of that, let's catch up on the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
One of the most sensational trials the Vatican has seen in decades is drawing to a close, with a verdict expected tomorrow on the charges of aggravated theft against Pope Benedict's former butler Paolo Gabrielli. He leaked sensitive documents, some of them alleging corruption in the Vatican, to an Italian journalist. The senior advisor of communications for the Vatican, Gregory Burke, said that the week-long trial has sent a clear message of no tolerance approach by the Pope.
The importance of this trial has been that the Vatican's showing that it's taking a serious breach of trust, a serious crime, if you will. It's taking it very seriously. I think in the past there's often been the idea, well, anybody could get away with anything, and that's clearly not the case. I think it has to do with the Pope basically wanting more transparency and more accountability on the part of the Church. Paolo Gabrielli may well be pardoned, but it will certainly send a message in the Vatican about how people behave.
The Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras has welcomed the decision by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel to visit Athens next week, her first visit to Greece since the debt crisis began just over 2 years ago. She will fly to Athens on Tuesday. Greece's two main labour unions and one opposition party have already called for rallies in central Athens that day to protest her visit. Meanwhile, hundreds of demonstrators have today clashed with police in a protest against the arrest of shipyard workers who stormed the Defence Ministry complex in Athens on Thursday, demanding back pay that they said they were owed. Here, London's High Court has ruled that three Kenyans tortured by British colonial authorities in the 50s can continue with their legal action against the UK government. Mau Mau war veterans gathered in Nairobi to celebrate the court ruling. War Veterans Secretary General Gitu Wa Kehanga said Britain should apologise before the last Mau Mau veteran dies.
Don't forget that the British colonial administration did a great deal of atrocities to the people of Kenya when they administered our country without our consent.
The Syrian National Council has condemned the Syrian government's shelling of a town in southeast Turkey that killed five people on Wednesday. The SNC leader Abdelbaset Tsieda, whose exile-based group is part of a patchwork of rebel movements, called for President Bashar al-Assad to be held responsible for the deaths. David Morgan, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species' science chief, has said today that 67 species will be listed as endangered, but the bluefin tuna, prized by sushi lovers but said to be suffering from overfishing, was surprisingly not on the list.
This time around, we don't have a proposal in relation to Atlantic bluefin tuna that's been made by any of our members. That's not to say that interest in Atlantic bluefin tuna has declined, with the objective of making sure that bluefin tuna is secure for future generations.
And finally, a man found that security was not a piece of cake when he triggered an alert at Stansted Airport here in London. Justin Barrett was on his way to Spain when he was stopped by police as a birthday cake found in his luggage and meant for his son tested positive for explosives. The cake was shaped like a caterpillar and aroused suspicions. Mr. Barrett eventually managed to wiggle away to catch his flight in time. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's coming up for 6 minutes past the hour in London, and indeed, I guess, everywhere else except where they have those weird time zones where it's coming up for 6 minutes past the half hour, or indeed in Nepal, 6 minutes past the quarter hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se om Monocle 24.
Shandai, Efrog Newydd, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Up to 19 million Venezuelans will go to the polls on Sunday to make the awkward choice between extending the mandate of President Hugo Chavez or consigning the rambunctious populist to defeat, something it is difficult, what with one thing and another, to imagine him accepting gracefully or quietly. It's hard to know how El Presidente is doing exactly. Venezuelan election law forbids the publication of polls a week before the vote, but most observers expect the fight between Chavez and his principal opponent, Enrique Capriles, the former governor of Miranda State, to be close. Well, joining me now is Monocle's Caracas correspondent, Sarah Granger. Sarah, first of all, what is the latest election news?
Well, we wrapped up campaigning here yesterday. President Chavez held a huge rally in the capital, Caracas, which is traditionally really opposition territory. And likewise, his biggest rival, Enrique Capriles, held his final rally in Barquisimeto, a city in the west of the country, which again is traditionally a Chavista area. So, you know, trying to appeal to those voters that could switch things either way for both of them. Today, things are relatively peaceful and calm, and everyone's getting ready for Sunday when, of course, polls will open pretty early in the morning. 5 o'clock in the morning they open. Turnout here in the last election was 75%. So if you think 75% of 19 million people, that's an awful lot of people that have to go and vote. So it's going to be a long day on Sunday.
You mentioned that the Caracas, the capital, as is often the case with sort of populist demagogues, is not actually where their heartland is. But how polarized is Venezuela between those two extremes you mentioned, I guess between the city and the country?
I think it's fairly obvious. If you look at the distribution, for instance, of the governors, each state has a governor, and the three states that contain the biggest cities are all led by opposition governors. And then almost everywhere else has a Chavista governor. So that kind of split between city and country is pretty obvious. I asked a few people this week, you know, where are the floating voters? Because I don't know many Venezuelans who aren't decided one way or the other pretty strongly. And they said, you know, they tend to be kind of middle income people who probably don't live in the capital city, live in other urban areas perhaps, and who maybe have benefited from President Chavez's rule, have benefited from some of his missions and some of the social programs that he's come up with, but who also, you know, have jobs possibly in the private sector and could see that, you know, encouraging the private sector could be good for them in the long run.
What is election week, especially the last week before the election, like in Venezuela? Is it sort of full of big events and big carnivals, or would you, if you didn't know there was an election on, would you know there was an election on?
I think it very much depends where you are, because if you're not in a place where campaigning is going on, you know, life does sort of continue as normal. Having said that, I've been to campaigns for both of the main candidates, and I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen, I mean, it's like watching the Beatles, I imagine, when the Beatles were huge in the 60s, arriving somewhere when President Chavez, you know, drives his motorcade through a big Chavista rally, people go crazy. And likewise with Enrique Capriles, particularly women with Enrique Capriles. He's young, he's 40 years old, you know, quite good looking, fresh, youthful, and people, you know, really go crazy for them. So there is much more interest in the election here than, for instance, my personal experience in the UK, to give you a contrast. You know, people really are invested in this, and lots of people will go out on the street and show support for their chosen candidate.
Well, to apply to this one the always useful old electoral maxim that it's not your vote that counts, it's who counts the votes, is there general expectation that this election will be a free, fair and transparent process?
Well, in terms of election counting, I think, you know, the jury is out on that. I think if President Chavez wins by a clear margin, I think that the count will be over fairly soon, we'll have a result fairly soon. I think if it's going to be a close election, or I think if Mr. Capriles has sneaked a win, I think there, you know, it will take longer for this news to come out. There could be some negotiation. You know, if it's a really close vote, if it's a technical draw, if you like, then anything could happen, really. So there is confidence in the Electoral Commission here, but, you know, the advantage is still with the incumbent. The advantage is still with the government in that respect.
It's a prospect I referred to briefly in our introduction there, but what on earth would Hugo Chavez do if he lost?
There's lots of speculation about it. I mean, one of the issues is obviously his health. You know, treated for cancer over the last year, spent large chunks of time out of public life really having treatment. And that hasn't been mentioned so much since campaigning began officially at the beginning of July. But obviously we don't really know what the state of his health is. And also, you know, if he did lose an election, you know, if that might play into his own feelings of well-being and so on and so forth. If he is pretty healthy, then, you know, there are further elections coming up in December, local elections here, so there's, you know, more to play for on the political field, as it were. And then, you know, the prospect of an Hugo Chavez in opposition is a possibility, but I think it very much depends on the man and how he's feeling, because his socialist movement is very much a cult of personality, and it revolves around him. And so, you know, it's down to him as a person, as an individual, how he's feeling and how he reacts as to what really happens to the socialist movement should he lose that election.
Okay, and just finally and very briefly, Sarah, to do the appalling thing of putting you on the spot, who'll be president of Venezuela this time next week?
I think the advantage still stands with President Chavez. I think his election to lose. I think this is by far and away closest thing that he's ever experienced.
Yeah, Sarah, I think you're breaking up there, but I think we got the gist of it. Sarah Granger, our correspondent in Caracas, thank you very much for joining us. Now, from one South American election to another, all this week we've been touring the cities of Brazil ahead of municipal elections on Sunday, with none other than our resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, as the tour guide. Today we're looking at those cities which you may not have heard of and the mayors who may win elections in them, despite speaking German rather than Portuguese.
Fernando, all week we've been looking at the big cities across Brazil that are electing their new mayors this weekend. But today, in our final instalment, you want to take a look at some of the smaller towns, don't you?
Oh, yeah. And in Brazil, we have lots of them.
So where should we start?
Shall we start? I mean, it's a very interesting city. It's called Pomerode. It's in the south of Brazil. And it's funny because if you want to be a mayor there, you need to speak in German with your voters.
Really?
Not all of them can speak Portuguese.
Why is that then?
Well, the city was constructed by German immigrants. But the funny thing, of course, we have German immigrants in São Paulo and Rio, but they're quite isolated. And they even speak some sort of German dialect called Pommersplatt.
Okay.
And there's an interesting story. The current mayor, he's the first mayor with Italian ancestry. And but you know what he did? His vice mayor is from German ancestry and he can talk to the voters who doesn't speak Portuguese.
Excellent. So, danke, a bit more important than obrigado.
For sure.
let's move on to another town.
Well, that's completely on the north of Brazil, completely on the other side of Pomerode. And this city was interesting because it was one of the first to elect an indigenous mayor in 96, because 17% of the voters are indigenous. And it's interesting because the tribal leaders, they are the ones who actually command the vote in the city.
Okay.
So, Yeah, it's interesting. That's the funny thing about Brazil, you know, when more than 5,000 cities elect mayors, you have all sorts of unique...
You do indeed. Now, let's turn our attention to... let's talk about Afua, this city that's sort of like an island.
Oh, yeah. And 73% of the population depends on aquatic transport. So when politicians, when they go for their campaign, they don't go on their cars. They go on the boats and they kind of scream with the megaphones. And I can't imagine this happening in Brazil, because even when you're in São Paulo, you hear those cars all the time. I can't imagine the river, everybody screaming. And they have this some very funny method of transport called bike taxis or BC taxis.
Okay.
I don't know how to say that. It's very unusual. It's only in this city.
Okay. And now, finally, let's end with the city with the smallest population.
Only 805 people live there. And there was a case where the mayor was elected just by one vote.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's
so
yeah.
Every vote really does count there.
It does.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens right there. Let's end with a song. Where are you going to choose this song from?
Well, this song is from a DJ who was here at Monaco. His name is João Brasil, and the song is Baile Parangolé. It's a mashup of all Brazilian classics.
Perfect way to end. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much.
Thanks, dude.
As caminhas, descobriu que as terras brasileiras eram verdes e verdejantes, escreveu uma carta ao rei. Tudo que nela se planta, tudo cresce e floresce. E o Gauss na época gravou.
And that was João Brasil with Baile Parangolé, a mashup of some Brazilian classics, ending that discussion between Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Steve Bloomfield. Fernando joins us now in the studio to finish off this week's tour of Brazil. Fernando, good evening.
Good evening, Andrew. How are you?
I'm very well. I understand that election week in Brazil would be a good week to commit a burglary.
Well, indeed. It's crazy. We have this law where you can't be arrested 5 days before an election.
For anything. I mean, there must be exceptions to the rule.
Well, if the police caught you doing something, you can be arrested. But for example, there was a case, a prisoner, he escaped from his prison, and then the police officer got him, but then they said, oh, actually we can't arrest you because, I mean...
Am I the first person ever to have spotted the flaw with this problem? I mean, I can't imagine anybody goes out during election week. I just have this image all of a sudden of everybody in Brazil just sitting in a locked house with a shotgun.
Yeah, it's very weird. I do think that they did that because they said, oh, every citizen has the right to vote. But I agree with you about the flaws. I think we should maybe change that.
That is quite weird. What I wanted to talk to you about was there's two huge mayoral races happening as part of these municipal elections. We talked about a couple of small towns there. Now I think we should talk about a couple of really big and important cities, the enormous city of Sao Paulo, but first of all, Rio de Janeiro, because whoever wins that election is going to have a World Cup and an Olympic Games on their watch.
Exactly. And the election in Rio, actually, there is no surprises. Eduardo Paes, I think, is going to win comfortably. He's like with 58% in the polls at the moment. And Carioca's liking, and he's very charismatic. And I'm pretty sure that's a race that's been defined.
Is he going to win because he's the guy who brought the World Cup and the Olympics to Rio? Or is that just, you know, did he just manage to get the World Cup and the Olympics because he's a good mayor?
I think he's a very good mayor, and he likes to project Rio as an international city, which São Paulo didn't manage to do that. And there's been this process of pacification in the favelas in Rio, which has been, I mean, fairly successful. And that's one of the reasons why he's so popular in Rio as well. And a lot of parties, including the Workers' Party from President Dilma, supports him as well.
And in Sao Paulo, though, it's a bit more complicated. In fact, it's a bit more complicated than usual. What's usually a two-horse race is now a four-horse race.
It's incredibly complicated, actually.
None of them are actually horses. We should probably stress that. They're four, you know, bipedal humans campaigning for Sao Paulo's mayoralty. But, talk us through this one.
Sure. Well, first we had this candidate, Celso Russomanno, which was a kind of a one-off candidate. He used to be a TV host, championing consumers' rights. And he was the leader with 30%. But now, since last week, the two next candidates, they start attacking him quite a lot. And now he dropped 5 points. And José Serra, the center-right candidate, is catching up. And the Workers' Party as well. And now we have another one from the centrist party PMDB, the same party as Mr. Paes in Rio, and he's catching up as well. So basically, there will be a second round, but we don't know yet who is going to be fight against who.
Who would your preference be, just out of interest, of those four candidates?
Well, I would say Fernando Haddad from the Workers' Party. I think he would be great because I think José Serra is a bit... He's running like a tired campaign.
Serra has been round the block more than a few times, hasn't he? Twice defeated candidate for president, in fact. It sort of looks like he's stepping down the weights like a racehorse who can't keep up with
And he was the mayor of São Paulo before. So I think we need new blood, but not Rousseau.
Well, we shall look forward to seeing how that turns out, and we will doubtless have you back to discuss the results when we know them. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us. It's 22 minutes past the hour here in London and indeed everywhere else. Specifically, it's 22 past 1800 hours here in London. You can figure out the time where you are. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
As the mother of all book fairs in Frankfurt approaches, all this week on Monocle 24, we'll be turning the pages on the world of publishing. From the self-publishing New Yorkers to the Berlin bookhouses who continue to triumph in physical form. We'll explore the challenges and opportunities posed by the digital revolution and assess the impact of new technologies on the bookseller and the publishing house around the world. Plus, we'll hear what there is to look forward to at this year's fair, and we might meet a translator or two as well. That's the publishing series all this week on The Globalist and The Daily, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. As recently as Wednesday night, UK time, this observer was among the many looking forward to the first debate of the US presidential campaign and confidently expecting a resounding defeat for Mitt Romney, who has for weeks appeared unable to open his mouth without affronting yet another vital demographic. It didn't work out like that, however. Most outlets called the debate a convincing win for the challenger against an incumbent who appeared vaguely stricken throughout by the thought that there was something more interesting or important he could be doing. Well, joining us now to assess the damage is David Usborne, US editor of The Independent. David, was Obama really that bad, or has that narrative now just taken hold and acquired its own momentum?
Yeah, you know, I was in the press filing center at the debate with 3,000 other journalists, and you could feel the pendulum swing within about 5 minutes of the debate starting, and the media reaction, which is also aided by what we're told in the spin room at the end of it all, it does have an impact on the perception very much. You know, it gains its own momentum and obviously swung very heavily against Mr. Obama, who was, I do think he was seemed sort of decaffeinated and detached in a way that he often does, to be quite honest. The real shock to me was less Obama. It was more Romney, who I did not expect to come running out of the gate so fast, so confident, so passionate, and frankly very articulate, disregarding the substance of what he was actually saying.
Why do you think Obama did so badly? I'm kind of tickled by Al Gore's theory that the altitude in Denver got to him, but I'm guessing that's a minority opinion.
Well, you know, I find it difficult flying from sea level to 5,000 feet. I think if you're a mountain climber or a sportsman, you know that you have to phase yourself into these changes of altitude. And, you know, it does sound like a bit of a desperate gambit by Al Gore to suggest that. But on the other hand, you know, maybe there's something in it because Romney had been in Denver for 3 days prepping, and maybe his campaign had seen the danger of a sudden change in altitude, and the president's campaign didn't. He prepped in Nevada at about 1,500 feet.
I mean, the biggest mystery to many onlookers, certainly myself among them, was that Barack Obama did not once utter the phrase 47%, a clangor which I see Mitt Romney's been trying to walk back again today. Why did Obama not do that? Was he trying to appear sort of lofty and presidential and not like a street-fighting brawler?
You know, sometimes I think that President Obama is a bit embarrassed by his own campaign. He said something like that at the convention where he said, to the audience there, look, if you're getting sick of all the TV ads and all the money being spent, so am I. And he's also said in the past that his campaign sometimes goes a bit further in its statements than he personally would like. So I sort of think that, you know, in his rather snobbish way, frankly, he forgets that he's a politician sometimes. And I think he doesn't altogether embrace what the rest of his campaign is doing on his behalf. And he would rather stay above the fray. I spoke to his top aide, David Plus, afterwards, and he told me that it was simply that they had taken the view that the whole world knew about the 47% already, and it wasn't worth going back there. But that seems like old politics to me.
Is there any indication at all that, from Romney's point of view, that the debate has moved the polls in his favour?
We haven't really seen yet, Andrew. We'll see, I would suspect, by the end of this weekend what's going on. David Plouffe said to me he doesn't care about the national polls, which seemed to me to suggest that he expects them to draw even there, or maybe Mitt Romney even to overtake for a short while. But it's, as he said, it's the state-by-state polls that really matter. I think that, you know, at the very least, the debate has changed the narrative for both these candidates in favour of Mitt Romney. And as you said in your introduction, we were all sort of almost writing Governor Romney off a few days ago before this debate. And now I think it's fair to say that the race is competitive again.
Well, one statistic that has been released is, of course, today's jobs report. Is that going to be a huge bounce for Barack Obama, or a small bounce, or any sort of bounce at all?
It's very, very helpful for Barack Obama. I mean, of course, 7.8% is still high, but it's down below the magic, or not so magic, 8%.
Yeah, it suddenly seems like a much smaller number than 7.8, doesn't it?
It does. I'm going to have to get used to it. I've been writing 8 for so many years, it's going to be like changing the date at the end of the year. So, no, it is very helpful. It's very hard to know where this is all going to go now. How much of an impression the debate, Romney's body language and so forth, made on viewers, as against things like the jobless statistics. Interestingly also, you know, they are hitting back pretty hard now, the Obama campaign, accusing Mr. Romney of fabricating a lot of the things he was talking about in the debate. And this thing about cutting Big Bird of Sesame Street is one of those useful popular notions that catches people's imagination. And
it could be the 2012 Joe the Plumber.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that. Having met Joe the Plumber, I think I'd rather keep the company of Big Bird. So yes, you're probably right.
Well, just briefly and finally, then, he's got until Tuesday week in New York to get his act together for the second debate. What does the president need to do?
Well, the second debate is odd because it's going to be a town hall meeting with questions asked by people in the audience. So actually, I think in those surroundings, it's rather more difficult to become suddenly much more aggressive and take on a sort of more of an attack dog role, which is what everyone is saying the president should do. But when you're in that sort of daytime talk show setting, I think that might be quite difficult. So, but I think that he's under tremendous pressure to be more aggressive and, frankly, just wake up a bit.
David Osborne, US editor of The Independent, thank you as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And in the next half hour, we'll hear from the Royal Institute of British Architects on the UK Education Secretary's assertion that schools should no longer be curved. Find out why the Frise Fair Art Director is including the Masters in their new programme. So all that plus more and some music too. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. One of the most sensational trials the Vatican has seen in decades is drawing to a close, with a verdict expected tomorrow on the charges of aggravated theft against Pope Benedict's former butler, Paolo Gabrielli. He leaked sensitive documents, some of them alleging corruption in the Vatican, to an Italian journalist. The Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras has welcomed the decision by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel to visit Athens next week, her first visit to Greece since the debt crisis began just over 2 years ago. She will fly to Athens on Tuesday. Here, London's High Court has ruled that three Kenyans tortured by British colonial authorities in the 50s can continue with their legal action against the UK government. Marmar war veterans gathered in Nairobi to celebrate the court ruling. The Syrian National Council has condemned the Syrian government's shelling of a town in southeastern Turkey that killed five people on Wednesday. The SNC leader, whose rebel exile-based group is part of a patchwork of rebel movements, called for President Bashar al-Assad to be held responsible for those deaths. And the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species has said today that 67 species will be listed as endangered, but the bluefin tuna, surprisingly, wasn't on the list. And those are the stories for the moment on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, live from London. Now, in a sneak preview of his column for the Weekend FT on newsstands from early evening Asia time, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, dissects the design issues with office environments that look more kindergarten than corporate. Silicon Valley, you stand accused.
How often do you show up for a meeting in unfamiliar territory and are suddenly slammed with an extreme case of office envy? Do you find yourself sensing that you're in for a bit of a treat the second you glide into a lobby, or is it more a case of emerging from a lift and finding yourself transported into a heavenly environment? Can you remember the last time you experienced that odd mix of elation and jealousy after drifting through a beautifully designed, serene environment? I have a couple of offices on my circuit that I always enjoy visiting and never fail to walk away thinking, next time I need to install this type of door, fit those type of floors, design my reception like that, or make sure my receptionist comb their hair or apply their makeup, boys excluded, just so. In Stockholm, there's always been something about the slightly sharp smell of the wood floors, the handsome yet practical furniture, that's made it a joy to visit the offices of Thomas Eriksson. In Copenhagen, you can't find a tighter ship than Maersk's global headquarters, with its subtle nautical touches, razor-sharp branding, and perfectly appointed furnishings. In Tokyo, I could happily move into the mansion come office of Wonderwall Architects. And in Milan, the headquarters of Diego della Valle is always a pleasant environment to enjoy a cup of coffee and a pastry or two. In all of these environments, there's comfort, attention to detail, fine materials, design for purpose, and a calm sense of commerce. As most corners of civilized society have been working from some form of orderly office setup for many centuries now, I'm somewhat perplexed how some of the world's biggest, even smartest companies can get it so wrong. More worrying is the frightful trend of turning corporate offices into play schools for adults. On Wednesday, a press release fluttered off my colleague Hugo's desk and landed at my feet. I stared at the images without reading the headline and tried to figure out what I was looking at. Was it a hotel? A nightclub? Tarted up jumble sale for vintage furniture? The set of a US cable TV series about the early days of the porn industry. What on earth is this? I asked. Oh, that! I thought you'd like it, replied Hugo with some delight. It's the new headquarters for YouTube in London. Why, oh why, do all these companies have to create working environments that look like romper rooms? I asked. I know, it's absolutely dreadful, said Hugo. I'm feeling a column on this very theme is about to be rattled out on my keyboard right now, I said, making my way from my desk. Anyone who spent a little bit of time in and around San Francisco, funkier corners of Berlin and Munich, warehouse spaces on New York's Lower West Side, and any other environment that might use the words tech or digi to define what part of the light industrial food group it falls into, will know exactly the type of environment I'm talking about. For a sector that likes to fancy itself as creative, it's remarkable how many fall for the same design cliches to show how down they are with the market, and why they're the right choice for grads looking for just the perfect home to amass a load of share options for a potential IPO. Without fail, there'll be skate ramps and reception, crazy furniture for otherwise dignified people to fall off of while they wait to be collected by interns carrying massive thermoses of lukewarm coffee. And there's a very good chance that there'll be lurid green astroturf underfoot. Once beyond reception, there'll be basketball hoops and maybe jogging lanes and tennis boundaries painted on the floor. Along one wall will be a bunch of plush animal heads mounted trophy style. There'll be lots of eating stations where people will be filling up their 500-liter thermoses with various free beverages, and as you weave your way past half-finished walls made up of particle board, you'll pass lots of young men who'll never glance at you but will knuckle-bump their colleagues and shout, "Yo, man!" when they pass along the kooky zigzag corridor. Somewhere just beyond the bathrooms that have been spray-painted by a local graffiti artist, you'll come to a screeching halt and ask yourself five rapid-fire questions. 1. When is this infantilization of the workplace going to come to an end? 2. Who is responsible for it and can they be prosecuted? 3. Do shareholders really endorse all of these extracurricular add-ons when staff should be working rather than brain-jamming while throwing around a spongy football? 4. Do all of these fun diversions really keep people in the office longer and put in more productive days? And five, does all of this nonsense mask the fact that working with algorithms and developing apps is hugely boring and unrewarding, and therefore requires airlock-style soundproof rooms so that staff can sneak away in search of more meaningful employment? Perhaps, like me, you'll come to the conclusion that these sophomoric playgrounds are not the indulgent grand projet of benevolent tech billionaires, but little more than upmarket versions of Foxconn manufacturing compounds. Who needs guardhouses and razor wire when all you need is round-the-clock free soda and crisps? For Monocle, I'm Tyler Brulé.
That was indeed our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. You're listening to Midori House, where we do not have any coloured beanbags. This is Monocle 24. We'll be right back after this to pick a side in the surprisingly passionate debate about what shape schools should be.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode of Section D, we hear about Ireland's craft revival. We drop in on the Monaco boat show and we head to Istanbul to find out what's happening to the former industrial buildings at the heart of the city on the Bosphorus.
People want this factory to live. It doesn't matter what it does, as long as it works and it creates energy and as long as it creates employment for the people.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
For decades, Detroit has been a poster child for the misfiring American dream. But amid block after block of post-industrial decline, there are signs that Motor City is jump-starting its economy, as Monocle Films discovers.
The phrase triple bottom line echoes around the city among small business operators. There is a dual desire, a sense of pride even, to make a success not only for themselves, but also for Detroit.
Retooling Motor City, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. This week, the UK government has released detailed plans to replace 261 schools it has deemed unfit for purpose. Their successors will be built according to baseline architectural templates that prescribe a no-frills approach to design. This crackdown on alleged architectural extravagance includes the prohibition of such fripperies as retractable partition walls, roof terraces, translucent ceilings, and curves of any description, and doubtless coloured beanbags as well. Will Fox, Head of Public Affairs for the Royal Institute of British Architects, spoke to our design editor Hugo MacDonald a little earlier and explained why the government is insisting on playing it straight.
The government have announced a set of baseline designs for new schools. So they're kind of standardised drawings, which I guess are supposed to provide kind of notional layouts for new school buildings. And they arise from an independent review that was commissioned by the government a couple of years ago called the James Review, which essentially concluded that new schools were far too expensive, that the process wasn't working, and that they need to find more efficient ways, ultimately, of designing new schools. And one of those proposals was for kind of more standardised designs, essentially, to cut down on the costs of designers, obviously, but also, you know, providing a template, essentially, that can be kind of replicated across the country rather than necessarily having a bespoke design for each place.
So it's a bit of a blueprint, and people have sort of fallen on the fact that this includes no curved walls, which are sort of expensive. But it also, biggest failure, I suppose, is that it writes out the fact that good design is linked to good environment, which is sort of beneficial to students. It's part of an ongoing discussion that we've been having in the UK for some time, that good design is good education.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly from our perspective, this debate isn't about architects or contractors, but it's about the teachers and students who are taught by those teachers and creating the best environments within which they can do that. And we're quite concerned that the approach being taken by the government probably doesn't have enough emphasis on actually the end user. It doesn't necessarily reflect the fact that different people different students will learn in different ways, that different teachers will want to teach in different ways. So in some respects, we're slightly concerned that this may be a bit of a straitjacket, really, and may not, and the designs that have been proposed, whilst they're supposed to be a template and can be adapted and innovated upon, they are quite restrictive, potentially. And there is a danger that we may be building a generation of schools that perhaps can't adapt as they would want to in the future, that won't necessarily be capable of changing, I guess, as teaching changes, as technology evolves.
Yeah, so it's a very short-term solution, but actually ignoring anything in the long term.
Potentially.
The extraordinary thing is that Michael Gove sort of came out with quite a vocal attack on the architect as well, and he name-checked specifically Richard Rodgers, which just seems completely unnecessary and, if anything, completely takes away from what is quite a sensible point if they've conducted research into how cost-cutting could be saved and how there could be this sort of formula. It's not really about a sort of government versus architect battle, this. Why do you think the government have waded in against architects specifically?
Well, I think, we've certainly never disagreed with the fact that actually previous school building programs were wasteful in terms of money and didn't always produce the best buildings. But I think with all these things, particularly when you get a new government, you need a scapegoat. And I think that it's fair to say, I think we feel that architects have been scapegoated somewhat. I think sometimes if you see a fantastic building, there are connotations that necessarily equates to a very expensive building. And actually, that's not necessarily always the case. And so I can't answer for the Secretary of State as to why he's picked on architects in that way. But I would say they're a fairly easy target, because you can see the building, and if it looks fantastic and exquisite on the outside, then perhaps your immediate thought is that it's incredibly expensive and wasteful. That doesn't necessarily have to be the case.
No. It's also extraordinary given sort of the success of the Olympics in terms of these beautiful buildings that everybody around the world, on the whole, thought was a huge success, and sort of showcased some fantastic British architecture. And the government were quite keen to sort of get behind that. What is it specifically about education that is the sort of stumbling block for them in terms of sort of not wanting to support these amazing architects and schools and monuments sort of for education purposes?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think that that's the case. However, I think they feel that actually you can have a much more standardised approach to things. I think they think it's perhaps wasteful to build iconic buildings, that's not necessary in an area. Mm. I think our concerns are much more basic. It isn't about the fact that we may lose a few curved walls or beautiful facades, and actually the standardised designs don't talk about facades particularly, but it's more about actually the space within the school. So they are going to be around about 15% smaller, big reduction in terms of circulation space, corridors, for instance. Fairly simple thing, but if you think about it, you think of when the bell goes after a lesson and you have hundreds of children piling out, if you limit the width of a corridor, if they're much more narrow, then there's a lot more congestion, potential for bullying. It's more to us, not necessarily about the fact that the government seem to want to, I guess, point out big name architects or are against iconic school design. It's more about actually the impact it will have on a day-to-day basis on children and teachers, really.
And that was Will Fox speaking to our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, earlier today. And this is Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. The 10th annual Frieze Art Fair takes place all next week in London's Regent's Park. It's an institution of the art world that champions the galleries dedicated to contemporary artists. This year, however, things are slightly different. The organisers have created Frieze Masters, a collection from over 100 galleries that celebrates great works from the pre-Christian era to the late 20th century. Monocle's Emma Nelson caught up with the director of Frieze, Matthew Slotover, to find out what it was all about.
This year we're introducing a new separate fair called Frieze Masters. This is our 10th year of doing the Contemporary Fair, which is now called Frieze London, to distinguish it from Frieze New York, which also launched this year in May. So it's quite a big year for us, yeah, a lot of changes.
It's a departure in many senses, because when you think of Frieze, you think of very modern, very contemporary, very alive art and artists. Why did you go in this direction?
Well, it was a number of reasons, really. In the first couple of years of doing the Contemporary Fair, we had some collectors come to the fair who loved the fair but said there wasn't really enough for them. They wanted more historical work as well as contemporary work. And we've also, over the years, had lots of galleries who show that kind of work, more 20th century work, apply to Frieze and want to participate, and we just didn't have room for them, especially with the focus of Frieze being so contemporary. So a couple of years ago, when a group of galleries in London came to us and said, look, we love what you've done for contemporary art, but there's a whole other world of art out there, and do you think you could do something similar for that world? We sort of thought, well, there are other collectors and there are other galleries, and if we could do it in a Frieze way, then why not? It would be fun to have a go and to learn this new world.
Were you initially resistant to the idea, or were you very welcoming of a completely new direction?
It is completely new, and we had to do a lot of that brand analysis business, which I've always been quite sceptical of and I'm not very good at. But we did a lot of thinking about what is Frieze, what does it mean to people? Is it weird or is it interesting? And the conclusion we came to, which I still think is valid, is exactly that, that if we can do it in a contemporary way, if we can have a contemporary view on things, you can have a contemporary view on anything. So then the trick was to do something new with historical art, which has been the challenge, and to bring those historical galleries and collectors with us.
I'll ask you what your conclusion was when you were faced with these challenges, but tell us what the challenges that you were faced with when you came to addressing this.
Well, really, it's a different world. You know, there's a different group of collectors, there's a different group of galleries, and the artists mostly not alive anymore. It's a very big scope. So some of the artists are alive. The scope of Frieze Masters is from ancient art through old masters to 20th century art and actually up to the year 2000. So it's in fact the whole of art before right now. Frieze London generally has been art that's straight from the artist's studio. Much of it has been made within the last year or a couple of years, and certainly most of it has come straight from the studio, from the artist. It hasn't been on the market before. With this fair, all of the art will have been on the market previously or would have been held for a number of years. So it's a very different atmosphere, different world.
You mentioned there that you're not massively market-focused, but surely if you're going to introduce a huge chunk of art into Frieze, you must have a clear eye on the market. And the clear eye on the financial climate at the moment, did that help to form your judgment or help to form your decision, and including old masters?
I mean, it's very difficult to second-guess the market. When you organise a fair, certainly when you launch a fair, you need to be conceiving it 2 or 3 years ahead of its launch. And to really know what's going on in the global finance market or the global art market or individual art markets 2 or 3 years ahead is very difficult. You have to kind of go on your gut of what you think is interesting and where culture is going, I suppose, which is, I suppose, what we did when we launched the magazine in 91 and the fair in 2003. We just had a gut feeling that contemporary art had a longer way to go, had more interest to come, that it was really interesting and enough people were interested. And that's sort of how we feel now about historical art, because the pendulum sort of swung from being only interested in very established big names and art history and 20 years ago not being at all interested in contemporary art, to being almost obsessed with contemporary art to the point that people have forgotten where the history is from.
You mentioned they're putting masters in a contemporary context and putting a Frieze identity on it. What have you done?
There's 2 or 3 things that I'm hoping will make the difference. One is the actual architecture of the fair. So we're using Annabelle Seldorf, who's great architect living in New York, who's designed a lot of old master galleries. She designed the Neue Gallery in New York, which specialises in Austrian art from the late 19th century, early 20th century, but also designed contemporary galleries like Hauser & Wirth, both here and in New York, and Gladstone Gallery in New York, David Swerner's New Space here. When she goes into a Picasso show, she designs it. So she's done a whole range of galleries and brings a very clean contemporary aesthetic to art through the centuries. What she's done is to limit the palette of the walls, for instance, in the fair. So at Frieze London, of course, it's mainly white walls, almost only white walls. We did think, could we just do white walls, but that would be very tough for a lot of the historical galleries, who like to put things on deep kind of reds or blues or greens. But what she said was, okay, you can have colour as long as it's grey. So there's four shades of grey and there's a white, and that will be the colour palette for the walls at the fair. You can choose any of these three or four palettes, but it will be quite a continuous kind of palette. So that will kind of unify the stands a bit more. What we're also doing is mixing up the galleries. So there's not going to be a section for for modern art, section for old masters. They're going to be bang next to each other. So you might get, you know, bronze sculptures from the 18th century next to Japanese sculptures from the 1960s. And hopefully play off each other. I mean, it's not curated. It's not like a show. But, you know, we hope that there'll be some kind of bouncing off each other and some unexpected juxtapositions.
And that was Matthew Slotover speaking to our Emma Nelson a little earlier. In a moment, we'll be exploring the delights of a new Basque restaurant in London. But first, here's Disclosure and What's in Your Head. Much runs for the big finish, Disclosure. That was Disclosure with What's in Your Head. Each week on Midori House, we endeavour to get to know the neighbours here in our Marylebonian enclave. I wonder if anyone's ever actually used the word Marylebonian as an adjective before. Well, they have now. And today it's the turn of Donostia, a restaurant that celebrates that most idiosyncratic of the cuisines of the Basque country, Pinchos.
My name is Nemanja Borjanović. I'm one of the owners of Donostia restaurant in Marylebone. Originally, I'm from Belgrade, from Serbia. In terms of the restaurant experience, I have none, apart from short part-time work during university. So no genuine restaurant experience before this. However, we do have a wine import business, Mountain Valley Wines, which has helped a great deal because we got a lot of advice from our clients on how to open. So. We opened in May, so just over 3 months ago. There's absolutely no Basque roots whatsoever. We just fell in love with San Sebastian, which is Donostia, the name of the restaurant in Basque. We used to source wine from San Sebastian and still do because it's surrounded by some of the best wine-growing regions, Rioja, Navarra, Ribera del Duero, Galicia, Ribera Sacra. We fell in love with the city, especially the gastronomy. The menu changes every Tuesday. Well, parts of the menu, one meat, one fish item, and we have daily specials. But to give you an idea, some of our signature dishes on the fish side are pil pil cod cheeks, The pilpil sauce is made from gelatin that's naturally found in the cheeks. So it's a very traditional Basque dish, and one that the chefs picked up while they did some work experience in San Sebastian. On the meat side, the pork shoulder, i.e. pluma, is the most popular dish. It's actually cooked medium rare, which is very surprising because, as your mum would always say, cook pork throughout. But because this is Iberian pork, that top quality Iberian pork that we import ourselves, it's fine to be a bit on the rare side. Marley bone, they're my favourite thing. I live here. The best thing about it is that it's got a village feel, even though it's in central London. It's very hard to find, and to our surprise, when we opened, there's much more residents here than we thought there would be. So there's a corporate side, of course, but we love the fact that we're a neighbourhood restaurant in a neighbourhood environment.
And that was Nemanja Bojanović from Donostia. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and that is all we have time for today. Thank you to our producer, Alan John, our researcher, Fernando Augusta Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Next on Monocle 24 is our weekly food and drink show, The Menu, where we'll learn how to cook like a top chef, have cocktails in Manhattan and coffee in Berlin, and find out about a new Chicago restaurant with a hard focus on its wine menu.
I've seen in the last year or so, maybe 2 years, this sort of emphasis and appreciation for traditional winemaking techniques.
In 3 hours' time, that's at 2200 hours here in London, I will be back with Tamsin Smith for the Monocle Daily. And don't forget, if you've missed any of our shows, you can catch up easily enough from our website at monocle.com/24, or you can download whatever you like from iTunes. There's hours of it. In the meantime, I've been Andrew Miller. This has been Midori House. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.